Warning, this podcast episode may contain explicit content, including swearing, discussion of sexual violence and rape, and other adult content.
Welcome to Crow Club, a Shadow and Bone and Grishaverse podcast. If you've been listening, you know that what you can expect from us are spoilers. Lots and lots and lots of spoilers for the Netflix show, every single book, every novella, every short story. We're going to spoil it for you. You have been warned. My name is JJ.
I'm Kat.
And I'm Anjali.
Today's topic is season two grab bag and listener questions and theories. Okay, so today we are going to be covering a bunch of topics for season two that we have not yet gotten to because we got completely derailed by amplifiers on the last episode, as well as some listener questions and theories. We have gotten some messages and some emails that have been absolutely delightful. We are aware that it has taken us forever to get here to talk about them, but we are really excited to be here talking about them in this episode. So in place of a fun name fact today, we will start with a quick update section on both this podcast and the Netflix show. So number one, as we said, realize it's been a really long time since our last episode. If you're listening to this, we hope it's worth the wait. Thanks so much for sticking around. Our other podcast / Bardugoverse update is that it has been announced that Leigh Bardugo has a new book. It is coming out in April, at least in the United States. Some people already have arcs of it, and I am like green with envy as I see them posting photos on the internet. It is called The Familiar. I am extremely excited about this. I have absolutely coerced Anjali and Kat into reading this with me. And so we will be hopefully doing a podcast about that book when it comes out, even though it is not part of the Grishaverse. It is an adult book as opposed to YA, and it is a standalone historical fantasy.
And in sadder news, the other update is, of course, that Netflix has announced that there will not be a season 3 of the Shadow and Bone TV show.
Wah, wah.
Yeah. How are you guys feeling about this announcement that was much anticipated? And then would they, won't they, would they, won't they? Our emotions were being toyed with. How are you feeling now?
I mean, I'm sad. I think that visual adaptations of literary works are always hard. And so I think we haven't been shy about sharing some of the disagreements we've had with some of the decisions that the showmakers made. However, it was also at the same time incredibly fulfilling to get to see this universe that I hold so dear. I've read these books over and over again so many times come to life. And, you know, some of the actors and lines were things that I never imagined and just were so great. And it's so sad that that isn't continuing. I did feel like parts of season two kind of did a disservice to the original trilogy, but I think they set up so many amazing things for a future season. It's such a bummer that that isn't coming to fruition now.
I think one thing that's disappointing about the show being canceled is how spot on the casting has been for me. Like, let's say they decide to pick this back up, do a remake. I think they would have a hard time convincing me, at least, that they could recast just as well, if not better, than they did for this version. I'm really happy, I think, with most of the casting. I think a lot of these actors were young and relatively unknown, and they've really grown into these roles and helped embody them to me in many ways. So that's super disappointing to see their journey cut short. I'm crossing my fingers that a lot of them will continue to have great projects going forward. And then as a reader / viewer of the show, it's disappointing because they were doing such different things with the same character and like initial starting places to not see what that full vision was going to become. Like, what is the Alina who keeps her powers? Who is she in relation to Zoya? Does Zoya not become Zoya the Dragon? All these storylines that happened within the Grishaverse books, the original canon, have been so fundamentally altered that as a fan of the universe, I would like to have seen how they played out. But now it feels like, oh, something is cut short where I don't know how it's going to turn out.
When my husband listened to our first podcast after season two came out, where we talked about our initial impressions, the first thing he said to me about it was, wow, I hope there's a season three, because it really doesn't sound like you liked season two that much, any of you, but you had really high hopes for what could happen later on if they did it better. So yeah, then there's the question of, would season three have been the execution on those things that we wanted? Would we have gotten kind of like a dark Alina and then a somehow revived Darkling? Oh, and then maybe Zoya would have been against the two. It literally could have gone anywhere. They queued up so many things in that last episode, which I know I've said, but the last episode really just felt like a pitch deck for a third season. So yeah, I am certainly bummed about that. I fully agree. I don't think they could do recasting that would make sense. Although Anjali and I have actually done Bollywood fan casting for this, if they ever decide to turn it into a musical with a lot of dancing. I think we have a pretty good lineup. So let's do the grab bag, or grab Bagra, as Kat reminded me, for things that we wanted to talk about in season two. And one of them, I don't know if you all have re-listened to our first episode about season two as many times as I have, which is a lot. But if you have listened to it maybe recently, you might remember that one of the things Anjali said she was really excited for was tethering, and that it was one of the interesting parts of the world that she wanted to see. And she said she both got what she wanted and didn't get what she wanted, similar to the Lance of Emerald. And so let us discuss the ways in which the tether was similar and different in season two than in the books. Okay, so what are the basic things the tether did in season two?
It connected all sorts of people I didn't expect to have connections to each other, and scenes and potential ships that I didn't think I had before.
So we first see it in episode one, right? And Alina thinks that she is dreaming. And so this is different than in the books, because in the books, Alina never thinks she's dreaming. She does sometimes think she's hallucinating, right? She thinks she's sort of losing it sometimes when she sees him through the tether before she like really understands what's going on. But in the show, it is posed as much more of a dream for her initially, and then later on for Mal.
Well, I mean, what really strikes me is kind of one of the differences between tethering in the books and in the show. And obviously, there are a lot of logistical differences. But I think in the books, tethering helps keep like the sexual tension between the Darkling and Alina alive, and really kind of makes you like want them to get together in some ways. And in the show, it's very interesting that the tethering allows Alina and the Darkling to talk despite that physical difference, but it really sets up these huge like emotional boundaries between them, and it's just filled with Alina kind of rejecting the Darkling, and the Darkling, I would say, ending up looking a little pathetic.
Yeah, a little. yeah, that is such a great point, because yes, the tether scenes were by and large, like, there was a lot of sexual tension in them, especially once we get into Ruin and Rising in the books. And it's so antagonistic in the show, starting, you know, right off the bat when they have their first conversation in the tether, and she tells him he doesn't even know the meaning of sacrifice, or whatever that line is that I've tried to block from my memory so I don't wake up in the middle of the night in a cold sweat thinking about it. And then she does one time try to convince him she's into him, which he doesn't quite fall for, but falls for a lot more than he should have, given all she's done is be really mean to him through the tether up until that point. So other people can use the tether. So in the books, it's the special thing that Alina and the Darkling share. And in the show, more people can use the tether than just Alina and the Darkling. So we first see this where Alina is fighting the Darkling and he's like choking her or something. It's pretty violent. And Alina's losing this fight. And so Bagra just touches Alina and joins the tether scene. And Alex goes, how? He has these like really good, like he just like yells how. I did write that in my notes that I enjoyed his how. And Bagra says something like, Have you forgotten who taught you all your tricks, boy? Amplifier of blood, it's all connection.
It definitely felt to me as a viewer and like from the books like a throwaway line to explain why Barbara could suddenly hop in there.
Would you say a throwaway line to explain or a throwaway line to wave away questions?
Yes, the latter. Definitely the latter. Like, no, this makes sense. You just have to think about it more.
But don't think too hard.
Yeah. Let's actually just go down this line of thinking for a moment. Let's say Barbara could hop in on the Darkling whenever she wanted and vice versa all along and going forward. Can you imagine in the books, it's just like, where does it end? Like, is anyone who's connected by blood tetherable? Like, that's a whole different magic world.
I mean, it's unclear to me if that is what she is saying, because what she says isn't an explanation at all. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if she's actually saying, because we share blood, we can tether with each other. Or if she's saying, like, I'm touching this amplifier and therefore I can touch you.
I definitely interpreted that as because we share blood, and that's how he then knows he can tether with Mal later. I do want to bring up the blood part, assuming here that she meant it, you know, familial, biological relationship.
Oh, wait, I'm sorry, I'm just understanding. Is it because they're both amplifiers and they carry that in their bloodline that they can tether to each other? Is that what she was saying? This is how little I understood what she was saying.
Yeah, I didn't think so, but valid.
Not my understanding of
valid is any other explanation that we have so far, I should say.
And that's why Mal, the other amplifier, suddenly joined in. And maybe that's why he could hear the stag, another amplifier, and the sea whip. And maybe the Darkling and Bagra could also hear them. And maybe that's why the stag is hanging around in the graphic novel when the Darkling and Bagra are passing.
But wouldn't they have heard Mal then?
I mean, this half-baked theory is now falling apart. Thanks, JJ.
You know, it does feel to me like a little bit of a strange maybe focus that we see on blood in the trilogy and also in the Grishaverse books, right? For Nikolai, his specific bloodline is a really, really big plot point and a big deal for his character, sort of a defining character trait, how he deals with the fact that he is not like biologically a Lantsov. And then Mal is kind of part of this bloodline. In the show, Mal is able to use his blood, right? So here we have talking about blood again, right? Morozova blood can open this workshop or wherever it was that Bagra brought Mal and Alina. And Mal's blood can open and close the door as well. But assuming the Darkling is even like 500 years old, I would guess he's a lot older than that. I mean, he's not particularly related to Mal. That's like 20 generations apart. Like the idea that Mal would have enough Morozova blood to trigger those things, to tether specifically with Mal, suggests to me that the Darkling would likely be able to tether with a large number of people around the world.
I do think, it's a good point just generally to like focus on blood and bloodlines here, because on the other hand, your primary character, the protagonist, Alina, we know nothing about her background or her bloodlines. And then when she creates her like new army of Sun soldiers, that is very specifically a power pass on. There's no actual blood heritage. So I think it's actually like an interesting point you bring up of this like dynamic here where sometimes bloodlines matter a lot. And then in the other half of the book, it's actually very unimportant. And she can just be an orphan without us knowing anything about where she's from or who she's related to.
So let's talk about this tethering scene with Malian. I thought it was hilarious. So basically, the Darkling comes to Mal while Mal is asleep in a tub. And Netflix does not take the opportunity to have Mal be naked in this scene, which it definitely seems like he should have just been naked. He's naked in the tub, but he's not naked in this tether dream sequence, which I thought was a lot of lost potential for additional hilarity. So the scene starts off with Alexander Morozova, aka the Darkling, aka General Kerrigan, saying to Mal's face, "All this time, I knew there was something I liked about you." And other than dropping "Call me Alexander," is there anything you can imagine Book Darkling saying less. He never even says Mel's name.
But also such a sexually charged scene and line to start off with. I think it's for the shippers.
And again, Mel should have been naked. Like, if they're leaning into it, they should have leaned into that. It was funny because one of the things that I had hoped for when we got a show was seeing more of the Darkling in one-on-one scenes with other people. That's not really something we see in the trilogy because it's from Alina's point of view. We see that in the Taylor. We get a glimpse into his and Jenya's relationship. We got a lot more of that in season two. We got some of him in Bagra, which was a relationship that was totally different in the show and really bizarre and not necessarily consistent. So I didn't find that quite as satisfying. And then it was also just, that was a strange start. So later in the scene then, after they're talking about Mal's like, oh, the Merzost is killing you. And the Darkling says, you understand then that I have nothing to lose. Mal says, only because you have nothing. You will die alone and I will die in her arms. Which is an amazing line, number one. And then the Darkling says, you will die when I kill you, cousin. Which I'm not sure that's like the best retort. The Merzost has addled his brain. But in response to this incredible, you will die alone and I will die in her arms, that's actually not what happens, right? In the show, Alina kills Mal. Yes, in her arms, whatever. But then she immediately runs over to fight Alexander while she leaves Nina with Mal. And then she spends all this time hanging out with Alex after he's dead while Nina's working on Mal and has to even call Alina back over. This feels like it should have been a setup for a thing that it wasn't quite a setup.
I do think that's a really interesting call out for you that, you know, here's Mal predicting exactly how he's going to die in her arms. And then like an episode later, he does die. And it's not like that. He was like, you know, I thought I was going to die in your arms.
Explain the breakup.
Didn't happen. We're over now that I'm back.
I don't feel it anymore, whatever that line is.
What do you think the overall point of that scene, specifically between Mal and the Darkling, is?
I think it's to give Mal a chance to, like...
It's his punch in the face of season two.
Again, basically. The tether scenes largely seem to be either, like, they're tactically trying to get something. The Darkling tries to convince him to just kind of disappear, but it seemed a little bit like a half-hearted attempt. That's not, like, a great plan. A lot of the tether scenes seem to be about Alina and Mal's character having a chance to say something rather than actually moving the plot or the relationship between them forward.
I think back to what Anjali said earlier, the fact that in the books, the tether scenes are mostly to keep up that romantic tension between the Darkling and Alina. Or not mostly, but they largely do that. And in the show, because that doesn't happen, it is shocking to me that anyone from the show can continue to ship Darklina. It's just like not there unless you're as delusional as the Darkling of the show is.
I feel like most show watchers who ship Darklina ignore a lot of season two. On to listener questions and theories then.
Let's do it.
Okay, I'll start with one from Mr. Sunshine, which is, I would love an episode solely on the conventional thinking and how much more Grisha could do, plants, dead matter, animals, as well as dynamics.
Yes, this is one of our favorite pet theories about how Robkin and Grisha just don't know how to think big and actually have the potential to do a lot more things and potentially... Grisha in other countries are more creative and can do more things with them. So what, other than modifying plants and affecting plants, which the Zemeni do, what other things do you think that Grisha, Ravk and Grisha are missing out on?
Well, Nina manipulates dead matter, right? The only thing that I thought was really interesting, I'm curious what you two think from Nina's powers, is at some point she's like threatening this guy in Firda with, he has cancer and she's going to like worsen it, I guess. Do you remember this? Like a tumor?
Yep.
Do you think that that fits in the world of Grisha magic and powers as you understand it?
I would certainly assume that's something that a corporalki could do. Probably in the reverse, I would assume. But I guess... You know, in...
Like heal?
Yeah. And, you know, they're called heart renderers when they use their powers to fight, but there's no reason they would just work on your heart, even though that's primarily, exclusively what we see. That's the sort of thing that I feel would be in line, although very subtle, for a Corporalnik to do.
Wait, that is such an interesting point that I feel like the heart runners of the books primarily fight using like heart stopping or squeezing. Is it just because it's like a quick, fast, and like something they've practiced? Or is this, again, being kind of stuck in a rut of what you were taught? I think the only other things I distinctly remember are them being able to tailor themselves and others, but not super well.
Well, I mean, they're either fighting as soldiers, and I think, it, as you said, it makes sense that the heart is usually like a really quick thing to affect, but like healers, presumably affecting all parts of the body, and the tailors are also doing all sorts of things to the body. I actually really disagree with, I mean, I guess Leigh Bardugo wrote it, so who am I to disagree with this, but the idea that Nina could be like growing someone's tumor, I think we got a comment
Postura Perim.
We got a comment from a reader that said, I really like how you treat the small science like an actual science. And so I, as a biology major, have some real issues with this, right? Like, I mean, yes, you think of cancer as, you know, an attack and something dying, but cancer is a growth of cells, right? They're rogue cells that keep multiplying and multiplying. And really it's living tissue. And that's something that a Corporalki should be able to affect do things to, and not Nina, who can only affect dead matter. A tumor is not dead.
One thing I think about, back to the heart renders and squeezing hearts, which I think we saw in the show how relatively ineffective that is, right? Like, you're squeezing a bunch of people's hearts and then they recover. It's not a super foolproof or particularly quick way to kill people, but it definitely seems like opening a major artery would be faster, easier.
Faster.
You know, the sort of thing.
More effective.
Yeah. The fact that they don't do that, I wonder if it says things about their mental limitations or about their physical limitations. So is there a way for hearts? Are you interrupting kind of the electrical impulses versus being able to ad hoc create a hole in someone's neck from a distance? Maybe that's scientifically more difficult.
What if we look at this from the more generous perspective of, not that Ravkins are not creative or small-minded, but they are a nation at war, and everything that these Grisha have done have to be honed for warfare. And it's all like, all their powers are seen through the lens of, how can this be a weapon and how can this be the most effective at, you know, killing people or protecting ourselves? What would Ravkin Grisha do with their powers if it was a nation at peace? So you can imagine, like, we're talking about these Corporalki powers. Maybe it would be like a land of great healers. Or maybe this is one thing that was mentioned about the Zemeni, I don't think that we've talked about, right? That Jesper's mother could make bread rise. I guess she's affecting the yeast. Maybe it could be a great culinary nation, a land of bakers, say from my very biased perspective.
Right. Two things I have to say about that. So, one, since you're a baker, Anjali, do you necessarily want to make bread rise really fast? Like, it seems like you're compromising on texture and taste.
No, I don't,
two,
actually.
Is the... Jesper's mom can make bread rise. So she's impacting the yeast, which is a fungus, right? And we see her like work with other plants. And that also made me think human bodies are just kind of covered and permeated by bacteria that are not our own cells. It does seem like Materialniks might be able to do a lot with a human body. I feel like these days everything comes out about the mind-gut connection, and there's all this stuff about probiotics and prebiotics and understanding the microbiome. That seems like something that in a more peaceful Ravka, or maybe in Novi Zem or something, that you might be seeing Materialniks do. But then we start really blurring these lines, and, you know,
are we not all things?
Again,
we get like hints of the inventions and technologies that might be possible from a country less devoted to wartime. In Firda at the Ice Court, when they have prisoners, even before Jurda Perim, there's a lot of inventions that they refer to as, this is definitely Grisha work. In Shuhan, similarly. I mean, it's body horror, I know, but obviously they're also doing a lot of pushing the boundaries of what's possible with Grisha power and technology as well, that we just don't see Rob could do, I feel like. And it's the biggest deal in the world when Nikolai and David start trying to like co-invent together. But it felt like besides David, we rarely see much invention happening. And his inventions, especially in the first world year, are by and large pretty small. He figures out how to make Alina's collar. He figures out those wrist mirrors. It's not to the scale that I think we see in some of the other countries or kingdoms surrounding Ravka. One of the interesting things from this listener question is about animals. And it's still one of the things that bothers me the most, that heart renders can't work against animals. That doesn't make sense to me.
Yeah, that may be the Materialnik specialty. This does make me wonder, as we hypothesized earlier, do humans have the connection to the making at the heart of the world or whatever, which is what the Korporalki are manipulating? And then there's something else for the Materialniks. Okay, listener Leslie sent in a prompt and a theory that I really, really liked. And her theory is that the amplifiers are a parallel to Sankt Ilya's chains. And this is like a little bit long and evolved, and I'm not going to get into all of it, but the part that I thought really struck me that I had not thought of at all before is Alina, the stag collar goes around her neck. It's called a collar, right? It's never called a necklace. The sea whip goes around one wrist. It's called a fetter. And the firebird, or the third amplifier, is always presumed to go around her wrist. And that setup is taken for granted. It's never questioned by anyone. And when you look at the picture of Sankt Ilya in chains, he has chains around both of his wrists and around his neck. And they're in exactly the position of Alina's amplifiers. An extremely neat connection that I had not thought of before, and it made me wonder kind of how deliberate that was on whose part here. Is the Darkling thinking about this? Is Bagra aware of this? Because she also tests Alina's second wrist, right? She knows that this is where it's going to go without being told. And it makes me wonder how much information about using these amplifiers together there was, and what the chain symbolism really says about them. They are chains, but they're also broken chains in some ways, right? She's not weighed down by them. They're not literally chained together, and kind of like Sankt Ilya in chains, where the chains are also broken, but you still see him bound around the wrists and the neck. I thought that was a really interesting observation.
I think that's an amazing theory. It never occurred to me in all the times reading this series. So super impressed, Leslie. I take for granted, yeah, we see Sankt Ilya in chains, but like, why? I guess he was arrested, but is that really what he's known for? Why is he called that? And I think it has to be somewhat deliberate symbolism. You could also take it to be like, what was Ilya's intention with creating these amplifiers? Why does he go through so much trouble to create these three amplifiers? What is he doing it for? My theory always was that Ilya Morozova did this on purpose, that he knew that there was going to be a sun summoner, and by putting on the third amplifier, it would share this power and create this different class of Grisha. It gives you a lot of power, but then it's also like a punishment. And for the person who has to wear the amplifiers, it's kind of like an imprisonment. And maybe that was his intention, and that sort of foreshadows that in some ways.
And the way that you break free from it is also by sharing it. So Leslie also wondered if we wanted to talk at all about the Darkling being a neat twist on the well-worn vampire trope. I'll say here, I'm not a vampire expert, but I did read Dracula for the first time a few months ago. So that is fresh in my memory. I learned a lot about vampires from there that made some of the cultural things that I've seen make a little bit more sense. Anjali and Kat, I know you're both Twilight experts. And because you sent me that one baseball scene that I watched on YouTube.
And every parody reel of it out there, I will continue to send to you both.
Great, thank you. And you were there as my support when I read the Wikipedia summaries of Twilight.
Mm-hmm. Here for you.
So do you have any kind of takes on the Darkling and vampire tropes?
I don't know if I have a hot take on it. I mean, I see obviously the parallels. You have this obviously dark creature, maybe doesn't like light, is opposed to light somehow, is very, very old. You have these like power imbalances, which are very common in vampire stories, where usually you have this extremely old vampire and usually this like very young ingenue that are somehow like paired up romantically.
The charisma factor is big too. Like everyone around him is drawn to him.
Oh yeah. And then I don't know if we're just assuming the Darkling is stunningly good looking, but I've just accepted that as a fact.
I think one interesting twist on this is that instead of taking like blood or power from people, he actually amplifies others when they touch him. So that's quite different from, I think, the classic vampire idea. When you think of vampires, you're thinking of people who take something from you, who are leeching away at your life force, even more than blood. So the fact that everyone feels so good when they touch him is actually really interesting. And it's, I think, quite a different take that makes me feel like some of his character may be drawn from vampire mythology, not even just Dracula, but there's a lot that's actually fairly different and unique to him. The last thing is vampires classically are defeated by things like the sun and the cross, so religion. And yes, the Darkling and the Aphrodite are not biffies, but by the end of the Grishaverse, the Darkling is a saint now. So that is not in line with classic vampiric mythology one bit.
That's really interesting.
You could also think about how in line with the trope, the Darkling is killed by the Sun Summoner with a dagger or a sword of light, depending on which version we're looking at, which are both shaped like a cross.
Okay, and then to round this out, since I know we all love this, in the end, he is stuck in a tree that's draining his life force out.
Yeah, vampires sleep in coffins, so him spending eternity in a tree, that's practically what you'd expect. It is interesting. I think that is a difference in the Ben Barnes portrayal versus the book portrayal. I think like the book portrayal, he feels otherworldly a little bit in the way he looks, in a way that you might like expect a vampire, whereas Ben Barnes is just like really hot and doesn't really look like a vampire. In fact, Ben Barnes, I feel like, makes his career on not looking like a vampire and then suddenly being a vampire sort of thing. So maybe that's also part of the trope inversion.
It's funny. So our next reader question or comment is from Sophie. The Darkling was an amplifier and Alina killed him. If she had somehow absorbed some of his powers, then him stabbing her hand later on in Rule of Wolves might make more sense. Thoughts?
Yes. yes. This does make a lot more sense. And I think we've talked about this at length, which is, I think, why Sophie's trying to help us out here on how confused we are about how exactly he got his powers back. And I think Bardugo probably was deliberate in leaving it vague because there isn't a great in-world explanation. But I really like this one as a reason that he would also need to stab Alina's hand. And because I think it leaves some potential for my girl Alina. Shadow powers do seem like the sort of thing that once she killed the Darkling, she might never really try to interact with again. And we know how good she is at repressing her powers and like ignoring things that are lingering there. And so if she had, you know, like a wisp of his power left, I could see that kind of being something that she didn't know, maybe because she didn't want to know. I do like this idea of this lingering connection that served this purpose narratively as well. So Sophie also let us know that in something that we had been confused about before, where we had thought that the Darkling had sent Zoya away in Shadow and Bone after she breaks Alina's ribs. And then Kat was convinced that that was the case. And then I was like, no, that was just in a fic I wrote. And I had incepted in Kat's head. But Sophie said that they also thought that this was the case. And we realized when we were rereading the Taylor to discuss it, that in the Taylor, the Darkling does send Zoya away. And so I think that's where I got it from my fic, where Kat got it from, or maybe from my fic. But it is interesting that we have those two different things. In Shadow and Bone, he very much does not send Zoya away. And in the Taylor, he does. And I think, given what I've seen, just like chatter on the internet, for a lot of people, that version from the Taylor makes a little bit more sense and seems to be something that people don't have a problem taking as the primary canon, where it contradicts Shadow and Bone.
And then we have one last question from Izzy. With the news of Leigh Bardugo's 8-figure book deal with Macmillan, I'm hopeful that we'll get more Grishaverse stories. What new stories would you like to see, or any predictions on what she will do?
One prediction that would be pretty straightforward would be the crow's heist to get the St. Felix heart, and then they turn the Darkling into a mortal and get him out of the tree with it, and Zoe and Nikolai probably get married at the end of that. In terms of things that I would like from our discussion earlier, something in a peacetime country that explored the boundaries of what the small science could do without breaking them, a la Gerda Param or Zoya becoming a dragon, but really within these boundaries and defined them more. I would really love that. I also think it is probably no surprise to anyone that I would just like more information about amplifiers. If she published a 100-page manual on here is exactly how amplifiers work, I would love that as content. That would just be beautiful.
I mean, I think I've made it very clear. I've probably repeated this like 4 or 5 times just in episodes of our podcast alone. I want a prequel focusing on Morozova, Bagra's sister, maybe kind of the backstory there. And also like the story of how that kind of explains how Alina got her powers. I just think there's so much interesting potential explanations in there. So, you know, I'm up for a manual, or I'm up for a manual in story form.
I think similarly to Anjali, I would love to see the stories of Swanbreaker, Morozova, and Bagra, but in the future. Because I still am in the camp that at least 2, if not all of those, are alive. So I'd like to know what they're up to and what their future holds. And then maybe hot take, I think I mostly would be excited for new characters in like different areas rather than revisiting some of the old characters. I think sometimes, and this is just my own personal bias coming through, I think sometimes authors, when they bring back a beloved character, it feels like, feels a little flat to me, like they're almost doing them a disservice. Not just because I want them to have their like happy ending and it's like dragging them away from that, but because we already know them, we know their struggles, and I love the beginnings of books and new premises. So that would get me super excited. The one exception is I would happily read a new story about Jesper and what's going on with him and Wyland, and like, you know, how do things unfurl for him.
What about also Nina and Hannah? I mean, I think that's
an interesting kind of... I can't see that going well. They're going to figure out that Hannah is not the real prince. It's like disaster. I'm already cringing, stressed for them.
I would love a story about them just so we can stop dead naming Hannah, because I just don't have anything better to call him.
True.
Yeah. Yeah, I think probably something too in-depth there, like the politics there wouldn't necessarily play to what we've seen as Bardugo's strengths throughout these series. We were like talking about books, but there are so many of these scenes or short stories or novellas. We got The Tailor, we got Demon in the Wood. For sure, 5 more Darkling Bagra things in between there. Like, how do you get from Demon in the Wood to Shadow and Bone? What did that look like? I would read short stories or novellas about any of the continuing characters. I think Kat, I really agree that I would like new characters, but totally. You know, I say all this like I will clearly read whatever it is. Like,
yeah,
no matter,
like, let's be real, I think all 3 of us are going to read no matter like whatever comes out, no matter what it is.
Yeah, since we're talking about Bardugo books and we're also talking about how excited we are about The Familiar, I think it's worth calling out, as people may have noticed, we have not talked at all about Ninth House or Hellbent, which are Bardugo's adult fantasy set in Yale, I think, and those are extremely, extremely dark, with, I would say, a list of trigger warnings as like long as your arm. And those were not books that we ended up either making it through or feeling like we wanted to really dive into because of a lot of the material. So we're just not going to be covering those, but like holding out incredible hope for The Familiar, where we can talk about more Bardugo that isn't just Grishaverse. I gotta say, the last thing from listener Sophie will bring up here is that she said, JJ... She called me by name, and she said, we need a Dark Lena wedding cake, because when you did the Dark Lena episode, you were not having Anjali design wedding cakes at the end of every episode, and we need one. And I was like, you are right. We need one. And so I am thrilled today, Anjali, to ask you, on special request, can you design a wedding cake for Alina Starkov marrying Alexander Morozova, aka the Darkling?
Yes, yes, I can. So for Alina and Sasha's wedding, I would design a very tall, I'd say about 6 or 7 tier cake that would be black on the outside. I am borrowing a little from my inspiration for the Darkling's birthday cake. So it'd be pure black with gold foil designs on it depicting the sun and the moon phases. You know, maybe a few like stars and lightning strikes in there. The interior, or I guess the flavor, would be, this is a cake that's very near and dear to my heart. It's what I made for my own wedding cake. I don't know if any of you or listeners have eaten at Momofuku Milk Bar, but they have a signature cake. I don't think they even make it anymore, but it is passion fruit curd with chocolate chip like cake and dark chocolate crumbs. And I find this like a very fascinating juxtaposition of dark and light that tastes incredible and is my favorite flavor in the world, but I think also very representative of these two battling personalities and powers. And I think the idea of cutting into this extremely, you know, like ebony black cake and seeing this beautiful, sunny passion fruit curd inside is a great marriage of both Alina and the Darkling's powers and personalities. JJ did say, I expect to see this cake make a light show when you cut into it. And, you know, it might do that too, but JJ is going to work out all the logistics of that and not me.
Yeah, well, then I said probably more important was that you'd be able to save the top layer in the freezer for their 100th anniversary. But also, it didn't occur to me until you said it, but they probably have to capital C cut the cake, right?
Oh, yes. Yes, of course. Of course.
So before we end it, I have a special edition of Kiss, Marry, Kill for us to do today, which might be
Anjali's eyes. The way Anjali's eyes just got so big.
No.
Okay. Today's special edition of Kiss, Marry, Kill is actually couples. You are not part of it. This is not like a threesome thruple situation, but which ones you would choose basically for your kiss, marry, kill. They're all show characters, to be clear too.
Who would we choose to get married, to kiss each other, and to kill each other?
Basically, it's my kind of question to test how much you ship some of these, let's say, out there possible couplings.
Oh dear. Oh dear.
All show characters. So we have show Darkling and show Mal, thanks to that tether scene discussion. We have show Zoya and show Nina, thanks to me and Anjali trying to get them to flirt all season two. And we have show Alina and show Inej.
Okay. Okay. I have it. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Show Darkling and show Mal kiss, because that tether scene should have gone in that direction.
Showed you the potential.
Yeah, that would have been an interesting, like, if you're going to do that, explore the relationship a little bit. Nina and Zoya should have to get married for some convoluted political reason. And then we just get to watch them fighting and bickering, but then eventually working it out. And it actually ends up going really great later on. I think that could totally be a thing where show Nina convinces show Zoya that love is possible, and show Zoya reminds show Nina how much she used to care about Ravka, and, you know, stuff like that. And then, just because sometimes I actually really like angst and tragedy, I think there should be some sort of situation where Alina needs to sacrifice herself and Inej has to be the one to do it. And so Inej has to kill.
No.
Inej has to kill Sancta Alina. You get the angst. You get.
You are evil.
You're the one who made these all up. Okay. Someone had to kill each other. And we know Mal killing the Darkling would be like the most boring thing ever. And
it'd
the Darkling
be like
killing Mal.
Just a couple punches in the show. Yeah.
And the Darkling killing Mal, I don't think would be particularly satisfying either. But I think this really has the potential to, like, have some serious emotional depth to it.
Mm-hmm. I like that a lot. I think for myself, this is actually one of the hardest ones that I've given myself, personally, because a lot of these are ones where I've been like, oh, there's something interesting here. I think my answer is actually going to mirror yours in some way, such as the Darkling and Mal. I think, like, come on, we got to at least get a kiss out of them. I don't think that's a long-term relationship. I think they're in the show. Both of them are too devoted to their romantic interests. I actually just don't think the chemistry will last there. I think Zoya and Nina has the greatest potential to be a long-term compatible relationship. Not just for things like reigniting her patriotism, but also their personalities are really compatible and could give them a lot of interesting situations and growth opportunities to both go through. Although, to your point around the like tragic aspect, if Zoya had to kill Nina at some point, I don't even know what the setup exactly would be. I think it would be Zoya, because Nina is Junior, who she took care of, and like, you know, is
not in the show.
That's true. That is a very good point. In the show, they're like, I don't even know how to classify their,
they're like vaguely apathetic peers.
Yeah, that's true. I guess I'm doing a little bit of Book now, and Rule of Wolves especially.
Yeah, Book Zoya having to kill Book Nina would be too much angst even for me.
Yeah, it would be rough. For Alina and Inej, I actually think the opposite would be interesting to you. Alina has to kill Inej. Does Inej willingly sacrifice herself to her saint? You know, does it change the way she sees her saint, her religion, like anything, you know, going on? Like, what exactly would play out if a setup like this had to come to pass? I would be really curious to see what it means to Inej, especially. Alina in the show is like a stone hard like killer, so I think she would have no problem killing anyone at any time.
Basically, I really loved all of JJ's answers, and I fully agree with you. I rarely do that in a Kiss, Marry, Kill, but I think just the idea of Alina and Inej, like Inej having to kill Alina, is like the most dramatic, amazing thing I could think of. And it was just so filled with angst and pathos. I love it so much. Although I am amused by the idea, just the theory of Mal and the Darkling, you know, having to be tied together for eternity if like the Darkling is somehow dependent on Mal for his cousin blood powers, and they could just be like bro roommates who hate each other. I mean, I think there's potential.
It's like a sitcom. I will say it does strike me as interesting that neither JJ nor I chose Show Darkling and Show Mal to marry, given that we're both on the enemies to lovers tropes so much.
But there has to be something, I don't know, Mal I don't think has enough personality in the show to pull off like a...
But there's something that he's always liked about him.
All right, that's it for this episode. Thank you so much for listening. And if you have any feedback or ideas for future episodes or other things we should cover, please feel free to drop us a line at crowclubpod@gmail.com.